Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm reading for you today in digest format, CQ Magazine, for the month of February 2010. CQ Magazine is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Richard S. Mawson. Richard's call is W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Handyham is spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M at courage.org. The Handyham website is www.handyham.org. Let's begin today with ham radio news. Senate passes ham radio bill. A bill to force a federal government study of amateur radio's importance as an emergency communications tool has been passed by the United States Senate and sent to the House of Representatives. The bill, numbered S-1755, the Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Enhancement Act of 2009, is co-sponsored by Senators Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut and Susan Collins of Maine, the chairman and ranking minority member, respectively, of the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. According to the ARRL, the bill was approved by the committee on December 10 and passed by the full Senate by unanimous consent on December 14. It calls on the Department of Homeland Security to perform a study on, quoting, the uses and capabilities of amateur radio service communications in emergencies and disaster relief, close quote, and report back to Congress within 6 months with recommendations for action to clear what it identifies as impediments to ham radio, including unreasonable private land use regulations. The bill now awaits action in the House, where a compromise measure, H.R. 2160, remains stuck in committee. The FCC is proposing clarifications to vanity rules. The FCC has issued a notice of proposed rulemaking intended primarily to codify existing policies regarding the issuance of amateur radio vanity call signs. These policies have been issued in various public notices, but until now have not been formally included in the Part 97 rules. One proposed change would implement a 30-day freeze on reissuing the canceled call sign of a deceased amateur in order to provide adequate notice of its availability. We'll have more information about that a little later in this reading. AMSAT, China, launches first satellite. China's first amateur radio satellite is in orbit and in operation. The satellite XW1, and now designated HOPE Oscar 6-8, was designed and built by AMSAT China and launched December 15 from the Taiyuan Satellite Launch Center. XW1 operates in mode V/U with uplinks on 145 MHz and downlinks on 435 MHz. It includes an FM voice repeater, a packet bulletin board system, and an SSVCW linear transponder, as well as a beacon on 435.790 MHz CW. There's also an announcement in the news section of the Vibroplex Bugs. Call W4PA Buys Vibroplex. Well-known ham Scott Robbins, W4PA, has purchased a Vibroplex company and is moving the code key maker's manufacturing facilities from Alabama to Tennessee. Robbins, who is best known as 10Tech's amateur radio product manager, left that company in mid-December to devote full time to his new venture. He bought Vibroplex from Felton Mitch Mitchell, called W4OA, who had owned the company since 1994 and wanted to retire. Vibroplex is the oldest continually operating business in the amateur radio industry, serving Morse code enthusiasts since Horace Martin invented the semi-automatic bug key in 1904. The company's website, www.vibroplex.com, and its toll-free phone number, 800-840-8873, will remain unchanged in the move. And here's a bit of information for you satellite chasers or reachers for. Another satellite returns from the dead. If you've been following ham radio news over the past several years, you may be aware of Oscar 7, the long-dead amateur satellite that mysteriously returned to the air and has been operating ever since. Now, Oscar 11, which is UO-11, which had gone silent just before its 25th anniversary in orbit last year, has come back on the air as well. The AMSAT News Service, ANS, reports, it appears that its batteries can no longer hold the charge, but everything else works as long as the solar panels are receiving enough sunlight. Meanwhile, OU-11's designer, University of Surrey in England, Professor Sir Martin Sweeting, G3YJO, has been awarded the Faraday Medal by the United Kingdom's Institute of Engineering and Technology for his development of small satellites, of which UO-11. It was the second. It was designed, built, and launched in a six-month period a quarter century ago. According to AMSAT News Service, Sweeting was scheduled to deliver the 2010 Appleton Lecture titled Small Satellites, Big Future at IET's London headquarters in mid-January. What follows next is a CQ editorial by editor Rich Mawson called W2VU. His column is titled Zero Buys. Rich calls this one Communications on Behalf of an Employer, a quotation. A CQ proposal. First, he quotes part 97.113, prohibited transmissions. A, no amateur station shall transmit. Subpart 3, communications in which the station licensee or control operator has a pecuniary interest, including communications on behalf of an employer. Subpart 5, communications on a regular basis, which could reasonably be furnished alternatively through other radio services. Now here are Rich's comments. Over the past year or so, there has been quite a bit of confusion over exactly what constitutes appropriate and inappropriate use of amateur radio, particularly with regard to emergency communications and, quoting, communications on behalf of an employer, close quote. It started after a ham who worked for a hospital posted information on the internet about the ham station he had built there for emergency use and how he had used it effectively in a disaster drill. FCC Special Counsel Laura Smith emailed him that the provisions of Section 97.113 sub A sub 3 of the FCC rules, which we just quoted above, were very specific in prohibiting communications on behalf of an employer and made no exceptions for whether an employee was on the clock or regularly involved in providing communication services for the employer. In other words, his use of the station that he had built as a hospital employee representing the hospital in a drill was not permitted. The fallout from this email has been widespread and perhaps greater than anticipated. The goal, quite legitimately, is to prevent, quote, served agencies, close quote, those organizations for which hams provide voluntary public service and emergency communications, from taking advantage of us and our spectrum for their own internal use. Unfortunately, there have been growing reports of this happening in different parts of the country. But the net result of the FCC's no exceptions, no excuses interpretation of this rule has been an abundance of caution, with emergency service agencies barring their employees, who are licensed hams, from participating in disaster drills, to some agencies severing long-standing relationships with amateur radio groups in order to prevent any possible violation of the law. It got to be so significant that the FCC adopted a some exception, sometimes policy, saying it would consider granting waivers on a case-by-case basis, but only for specific requests from government agencies and only for disaster drills. Hams inquiring about the application of this rule have been told that if they disagree with the current interpretation, they should file a petition for rulemaking to change it. At least one group so far, which includes CQ contributing editor Gordon West, WB6NOA, has done so. That petition asks the FCC to codify an exception to permit hams to participate in emergency and disaster communications and training, quoting here, without regard to whether the amateur operator has related employment, close quote. This would, for example, permit National Weather Service meteorologists who are also hams to directly participate in sky-worn communications and training when necessary. We have no problem with this petition, but we feel that it does not go far enough to really solve the problem, because the problem extends beyond the narrow scope of emergency communications. This rule applies to all amateur communications, and broad application of this very strict interpretation could have far-reaching impact on the amateur radio service in ways that the FCC perhaps did not anticipate. For starters, employees of amateur radio publications could no longer conduct equipment reviews, since any transmissions made for the purpose of evaluating a piece of equipment could be considered communications on behalf of an employer, and would therefore be prohibited. Take it a step further, and I should probably just sell my ham gear, since people have a tendency to recognize me on the air and occasionally make a comment regarding CQ. Any response other than rudely ignoring them would be considered communication on behalf of an employer, even if all I said is, call me or send me an email. The greatest impact could be on a program that is universally recognized as beneficial for everyone concerned, the amateur radio on the International Space Station, ARISS program, ARIS. NASA considers ARIS to be part of its educational outreach program, and it has helped countless young people worldwide to consider careers in science and technology. NASA astronauts participating in ARIS by making school contacts during their personal time on a voluntary basis are clearly speaking in their roles as NASA astronauts and are therefore transmitting, quoting, communications on behalf of an employer, close quote. Now, for the listener, Rich Mawson, W2VU, the editor of CQ Magazine, goes on in detail about the different proposals. They're also found in the magazine throughout the article. Essentially, these are the guidelines that we have traditionally followed. We feel that this change would give hams the necessary flexibility to keep doing what we have always done, while still protecting the amateur radio service from being used inappropriately for purposes that would violate paragraph 5 of 97.113A, as seen in the beginning of this column. The ARRL Board of Directors will also be discussing this issue at its January meeting, which will have been held by the time you read this, and the League may file its own petition as well. The only unacceptable option is to do nothing. The current confusion will only hurt amateur radio and its relationships with served agencies and other groups. The FCC needs to find a way to restore the balance that has been lost between providing amateurs with needed flexibility and protecting the service from being abused. Our suggestion is but one possibility. More important than having any one petition adopted is having clear guidelines from the FCC. Now, for the listener, there is a major article in this month's issue of CQ Magazine for February 2010. It's titled VHF Slant, UHF FM Mobile Transceivers. The author is Gordon West, a well-known gentleman in amateur community, WB6NOA. It states here, our annual market survey looks this year at VHF UHF FM mobile rigs for use in your car or at home. Contributing editor WB6NOA reports that overall, prices have remained steady, while features and power levels have both increased. There's a great deal of information about this topic. It begins on page 13 of the February 2010 CQ and concludes on page 23. Very, very lengthy, detailed information and analysis of performance capabilities of quite a few of the newest receivers from all of the major manufacturers. Because of its detail and length, obviously I can't put that into a digest format reading such as mine, but I strongly urge anybody interested in what the newest of the handhelds and even some of the so-called table models are all about. You get some, and if you're not able to read it with you and for you. A lot of visual information as well as statistics about the performance of all these rigs is here. A great job by Gordon West, called WB6NOA. Also, there is one interesting bit of information within this article. I don't think it's attributed necessarily to Gordon West, but it's certainly in the magazine, and it's about so-called new radios being made available. Have you heard of red radios from, you want to guess, China? A bright red VHF handheld, along with a bright red 2-band mobile? I had to do a double take. Last time I saw a non-white transceiver was a clear case handheld. However, these bright red ham radios didn't carry any of our traditional industry recognizable names. They looked like imitations of the real thing and were imported directly from China or ordered through the internet. These Chinese handhelds, seen selling around $60, are beginning to flood the internet with little promise of ever getting them fixed when they go bad. Quoting, throw it away and buy a new one, close quote, seems to be the most common response. Now, though, we see no-name, two-band mobile radios on the internet coming in at a price that looks tempting. Be careful, as some of these mobiles and handhelds come programmed wide open and with an offset that could put you well out of band and into deep trouble if tracked down by the FCC. The instruction manual will not read in clear English, and you likely won't receive the heavy-duty construction you would in a regular-issue mobile ham set. The amateur radio industry has always resisted forming an alliance of manufacturers to deal with these matters. The FCC is likely too understaffed to look at every incoming shipment for proper certification, or whether these cheap imports are locked down to specific radio bands or wide open to transmit anywhere. One model is FCC certified for Part 90 land mobile use, but not for Part 97 amateur bands. Be careful. Let's keep our ham service clean of imposter radios and help support the manufacturers mentioned in my article, which spend hundreds of thousands of dollars supporting the amateur radio service. Stay with those manufacturers that you recognize in print, see at the various ham radio conventions, read about in magazine ads, and where you can actually place a phone call for technical support when you need some assistance in coming up on the air with new gear. If you really want a red radio, get out the spray can. Stick with ones you know, and let's hope the wide distribution of these knockoff radios won't be purchased by hunters and fishermen, ending up in the middle of the 2-meter or the 70-centimeter band. Worse yet, some of this imported gear comes with scramblers, and this feature alone is illegal and against all that ham radio is. Support our industry, which supports all of us as amateur radio operators. Commentary by Gordon West. Let's take a breather here and look at some special event stations that are scheduled for February 2010. The Call W3C Whiskey 3 Charlie from Pennsylvania Sportsman Show, Washington Amateur Communications, Washington, Pennsylvania. That Sportsman Show apparently runs February 1 through February 8. Again, the QTH there is Washington, Pennsylvania. A special call W7G Whiskey 7 Golf from a commemoration of George Washington's birthday. That one runs for several days, from 2200 Zulu, February 19, to 2359 Zulu, February 22, on all the various ham segments of the band. Special call W7Z, Whiskey 7 Zulu, from the 3rd Annual Snowbird Field Day in Mesa, Arizona. That's being sponsored by the Sun Life Venture Out, ARC. It's February 24 on the High Frequency Bands. Special call K8BF from the 5th Annual Freeze Your Acorns Off QRP Special Event. Location Kent, Ohio, Portage County Amateur Radio Service. That's a 1500 to 2300 Zulu February 27th in the general areas of 15, 20, 40, and 80 meters CW and single sideband, plus echo link through the KC8RKV echo link node. Call W9SBP slant W9UA from 1930s. W9UA transmitter built by MH Ensor. W9B SP, Kansas City, Kansas, Marshall Ensor Memorial Organization, February 21st on CW. Specifics for these short announcements are on page 10 of the February 2010 CQ Mag. The results are in for the 2009 CQ Worldwide VHF Contest. The information is voluminous, very detailed again. It's on pages 24 through, I believe, 29. Of the February 2010 issue. Submitting all this information is John Lindholm, called W1XX. I'll give you a short intro to it, however. A two-band VHF contest, such as the CQ Worldwide VHF contest, always sits on the edge of a precipice of poor conditions. For many, if not most participants, the 2009 contest fell over the edge. What's a reporter to do when the contest he's reviewing was not up to par by most standards? For openers, he can focus on a few brief gems of brightness, such as it was a fun contest, even though it got off to a slow start on dead bands. But 6 meters opened up on Sunday, adding to the excitement. There are little tidbits like that throughout the article. It's rather long, as I'd said a few moments ago, but if you are a VHF contester, or interested enough to want to find out what did happen and who participated and qualified well in any of the categories, you should get together with someone who has a copy of the February 2010 CQ magazine and look it over. And talking about the CQ contests, the 2010 CQ Worldwide WPX contests. The single sideband portion is March 27th through 28th. And the CW portion is scheduled for May 29 and 30. They both start at 0 GMT on a Saturday and conclude at 2359 GMT on a Sunday. And of course, there's a lot of information published as to all the do's and don'ts, can'ts and won'ts. Hi. So they're also in the February issue, I believe on pages 44 through 46. Let's go now to Washington Readout by Frederick O. Mayer, W5YI. Titled, FCC Proposes Changes to the Vanity Call Sign System, NPRM in WT Docket Number 09209, also addresses two petitions for rulemaking. The Federal Communication Commission surprised the amateur radio community just before Thanksgiving with a 14-page notice of proposed rulemaking entitled Amendment to the Amateur Service Rules Governing Vanity and Club Station Call Signs. The NPRM proposes some major changes to the vanity and club station call sign programs. In addition, many current policies would remain basically unchanged, but would be specifically added to the Part 97 rules. Previously, notification was through a posting on the FCC's website of previously issued public notices. Now, regarding station call signs and deceased licensees, the station call sign previously held by a deceased radio amateur generally becomes available for reassignment 2 years plus 1 day following license expiration or cancellation, whichever is sooner. The FCC is proposing to change when these call signs become available for reassignment. In order for a vanity call sign to be assigned to an amateur station, a call sign must be available at the time the application is processed. Even if a licensee is deceased, the call sign is not available if the license is still active in the FCC's database because the commission has not been informed of the licensee's death. A station call sign is active for a 12-year period, the 10-year term plus the 2-year grace period. The FCC cancels a deceased amateur's call sign as of the date of death when it receives proper evidence of death. Three types of supporting documentation that the FCC accepts are a copy of the death certificate, an obituary from a newspaper, or information from the Social Security Death Index, SSDI, that shows the date of death. The SSDI is an online database of millions of deceased individuals with U.S. Social Security numbers whose deaths have been reported to the Social Security Administration. It is located on the Internet at http://ssdi.rotsweb.anciestry.com. Sometimes the FCC also cancels a call sign on its own without this data when it learns of the licensee's death through other sources. While the procedure for canceling and applying for a license due to death of the licensee is shown on the FCC website, it is not actually stated in the Part 97 rules. The FCC wants to change that by amending Section 97.19 and adding a new section 97.21. There is a lot more information on page 54, 55, and 56 regarding when call signs of deceased amateurs become available, and also who is considered ineligible as an applicant. Let's go to the club station licensing issue. Disputes regarding the identity of a club's trustee sometimes come to the FCC's attention when a contested application is filed to change the trustee. The application must be presented in document form to a club station call sign administrator. A CSCSA is a tax-exempt amateur radio organization that has agreed to provide voluntary, uncompensated, and unreimbursed services for processing applications for club and military recreation station licenses. The CSCSA then submits the information to the FCC in an electronic batch file. There is currently no Part 97 rule requirement, however, that the documents submitted to the CSCSA demonstrate that the new trustee has been so designated by an officer of the club. In order to avoid commission involvement in what are essentially internal club matters, and to ensure that an application changing the trustee of a club station reflects the intent of the club, the FCC wants the rules to specifically state that applications requesting a change in trustee include documentation signed by a club officer when the application is submitted to the club station call sign administrator. Additionally, the commission believes that by accepting applications only from the licensee, the CSCSA can minimize the number of disputed applications that are filed. The FCC rules limit individuals to holding only one operator at SLANT primary station license and one call sign. There is currently no similar limit on how many licensees and call signs a club may hold. This gives club stations a distinct advantage over individuals seeking desirable call signs, reduces the pool of vanity call signs available to individuals and other club stations, and increases the possibility of conflict over particular call signs. To remedy this, the FCC wants to limit club stations to holding only one license and one station call sign. Clubs that currently hold more than one call sign would not be allowed to obtain any more call signs, but could renew or modify their existing station licenses. Finally, the FCC proposes to limit novice class licensees to serve as club station trustees. Novices were originally precluded from being trustees because many years ago, novice licenses could not be renewed. Now, quoting the FCC again, because such licenses now may be renewed on the same basis as any other amateur service license, we believe that this prohibition is no longer necessary, close quote, the FCC said. Filing comments on WT09-209, the FCC wants comments from the amateur community on all of these proposed rule changes. Radio amateurs may file comments electronically over the Internet using the Commission's electronic comment filing system, or by filing paper copies. Commenters who choose to file paper comments must file and original and four copies. It could be sent to FCC, Office of the Secretary, Federal Communications Commission, 445 12th Street, Southwest, Room TW-A325, Washington, D.C., 20554. Comments closed 60 days after publication of the NPRM in the Federal Register. Reply comments 15 days later. The comment close date for this proceeding should be about mid-February. This concludes our Washington readout by Frederick O'Meara, W5YI. Now here's some long-anticipated information. The NCVEC releases new technician class question pool. New Element 2 questions must be used beginning July 1, 2010. The Question Pool Committee, that's the QPC, of the National Conference of Volunteer Examiner Coordinators, released a new Technician Class Element 2 question pool to the public in January. Each question pool for the three amateur radio license classes, Technician, General, and Amateur Extra, is reviewed and revisited on a four-year rotation. This new technician class pool will become effective on July 1, 2010. The Question Pool Committee has been authorized by the Federal Communications Commission to determine the appropriate mix of written examination topics and individual question content that appear in the three question pools under the general guidance of Section 97.503 of the rules, which specify only that all examinations must be such as to prove that the examinee possesses the operational and technical qualifications required to perform properly the duties of an amateur service licensee. The Element 2, which is the technician, and Element 3, the general, examinations must each contain 35 questions, 26 needed to be correct to pass. Element 4, the extra class license, contains 50 questions, 37 of which must be correct to pass. Section 97.523 requires that each question pool must contain at least 10 times the number of questions required for a single examination. The QPC reviews the three question pools every 4 years to ensure that questions are kept current with the latest amateur practices and technology, as well as addressing information relevant to that particular license class. The technician question pool and exam are intended to be the beginning of the amateur radio journey and serve as an outline for ham radio license classes conducted by individuals and clubs. The goal of the new Element 2 question set is to enable the new technician licensee to be able to establish his or her station and operate it legally, courteously, and safely. Element 2 also prepares an applicant for the enjoyment of operating and serves as the beginning of learning electronics, the cornerstone of the education needed to advance to the higher amateur radio license classes. The new question pool will become effective for all examinations administered on or after July 1, 2010, and will remain valid until June 30, 2014. Study materials will be available from the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League, and the W5YI group, and on the shelves at ham radio outlets and bookstores about April 2010. Current technician question pool that began being used in Element 2 examinations on July 1, 2006 will be discontinued as of June 30, 2010. The new technician pool contains approximately 400 questions, Each 35-question element to examination is constructed by volunteer exam coordinators, or VE teams, selecting 2 to 8 questions from each of 10 topics. There are 35 different sub-elements, each having 10 or more questions. The new Element 2 Technician question pool will contain graphics and diagrams, something new for this element. Next year, the question pool committee will be updating the general class, that's Element 3, questions. The current general class question pool, effective July 1, 2007, is valid through June 30, 2011. The current amateur extra class pool, which became effective July 1, 2008, remains valid until June 30, 2012. I think it's time now to take a look at some public service commentaries. The author here is Richard Fisher, call KI6SN. It's titled A Bright and Sunny Sky Warn Recognition Day. Things were looking up, both figuratively and literally, for hundreds of weather-wise radio amateurs who operated from National Weather Service offices across the country or got in line on the air to have a CUSO with them during the 11th Annual Sky Warn Recognition Day on December 5, 2009. It's an event that highlights some of the greatest attributes and values of amateur radio public service. David Floyd, call N5DBZ, of National Weather Service Warning Coordination Meteorologist based in Goodland, Kansas, said SDR 2009, co-sponsored by the AHC and the American Radio Relay League, is a way to recognize the commitment made by amateur radio operators in helping keep their communities safe. Over the years, amateur radio has been playing an increasing role in supporting the NWS through Skywarn by providing real-time weather reporting on everything from hail size, rainfall amounts, and tornado activity to snowfall amounts, ice accumulation, and damage assessment during major storms. However, Recognition Day is a time for more relaxed operations. Not only does it give Skywarn volunteers an opportunity to gather for a fun on-the-air activity, it is also a chance to fine-tune operating skills and test gear and antennas. N5DBZ said 108 National Weather Service offices participated in the 2009 event, including the National Hurricane Center in Miami, where amateur radio has traditionally played a significant role during tropical storm and hurricane events. Although the SRD-09 data had not been fully tabulated at press time, early feedback indicated everyone enjoyed participating once again. Haven't heard of any big equipment problems or other issues. Looking back over the years, though, traditionally the log files indicate about 16,000 to 18,000 CUSOs are completed during the 24-hour period, David said. Not too shabby. Radio amateurs from around the world were encouraged to contact SDR-09 stations and relay their local weather conditions. Many of the NWS National Weather Station stations featured WX call sign prefixes. Now, for the listener, the article goes on to continue with snapshots of WX4NHC, that's the Miami National Hurricane Center, WX4NC in Raleigh, North Carolina, WX7LKN in Elko, Nevada, and 5CCW, Corpus Christi, Texas, and also WX1BOX in Taunton, Massachusetts. I'm going to read the information submitted by WX1BOX from Taunton, Massachusetts as an illustration of what really went on. Among the SRD stations representing the Northeast was WX1BOX at the National Weather Station Forecast Office in Taunton, Massachusetts. Quoting, the 09 event was very successful and coincided with the twice per year Skywarn Coordinators meeting, according to Rob Macedo, KD1CY, Kilo Delta 1, Charlie Yankee, who was ARIS Skywarn Coordinator for NWS in Taunton, Eastern Massachusetts ARIS Section Emergency Coordinator and Director of Operation for the VOIP Hurricane Net. 15 radio amateurs teamed up for the WX1BOX effort. A total of 309 CUSOs were logged, with 271 unique contacts made to 41 NWS forecast offices, earning the operation the Nor'easter Certificate, KD1CY said. These numbers were slightly lower than 2008, but we did not have our Skywarn coordinated meeting during SRD last year, like we did this year, and this likely led to a lower count of stations. Continuing Rob's comments, we had a Tentec Orion HF rig brought into the weather office for SRD operations through the efforts of Bill Boys, KB1G, and this radio was used in lieu of the Alignco DX70TH radio that is installed at the weather office, Rob said. Radio amateurs in the NWS Taunton warning area are responsible for over 90% of the damage reports received and half of two-thirds of the rainfall and snowfall reports received into the weather forecast office. We have a very active group that handles Skywarn activations from the NWS forecast office, working with NETS and net control stations that handle approximately 24 NETS across 4 states, he said. We also use Echolink IRLP through the New England Reflector System, NEW-ENG Conference System Node 9123/IRLP Reflector 9123. According to KD1CY, band conditions on HF were a bit weaker than 2008, but we still managed a several-hour pileup on HF on 20 meters that was managed by 15-year-old Jeremy Briff Plitz, KB1REQ. Jeremy has participated in several Skywarn activations, including two activations for tornadoes in our county warning area over the summer. We also had a number of contacts via Echolink IRLP on the WX underline TALK Echolink conference node 7203/IRLP 9219 system and the New England Reflector system. WX1BOX also managed Echolink net control for WX4NHC and fielded check-ins for 2 hours, KD1CY said. The author of the material, Richard Fisher, comments lastly, each month we seem to have more material for CQ's public service column than space available to publish it. This month is no exception. To handle the overflow and as a vehicle for updates and breaking public service news, we've launched CQ Public Service on the Web, an internet page that we hope you'll add to your favorite list. It's free and easy to use at http://www.cqpublicservice.blogspot.com. To kick things off there, you'll find many more photographs, links, and information from Skywarn Recognition Day 2009. Signed 73, Richard, KI6SN. Well, we continue now, reading in digest format, the CQ Magazine edition for February 2010 with Beginner's Corner. Beginner's Corner is authored by Rich Arland, K7SZ. He titles this work, Getting Current on Batteries, and introducing a new Beginner's Corner columnist. Hello, and welcome to a new chapter in CQ's Beginner's Corner. My name is Rich Arland, call sign K7SZ, and I will be sharing the column with your current beginner's editor, Wayne Yoshida, KH6WZ, on an every other month basis. As for me, I have been an active radio amateur for almost 50 years and a QRP-er, power 5 watts or less, since 1965. I am the beginner's column editor for CQ VHF, CQ's sister magazine. I have authored 6 books, including the ARRL's Low Power Communications, The Art and Science of QRP, all 3 editions. Was QRP editor for QST for 4 years between 2000 and 2003. Am the author of a whole bunch of articles published in various radio and electronics journals. Am an active DXer and contester, and also enjoy satellite communications. I've been married to my best friend, Patricia, KB3MCT, for 28 years, and we have 4 children and 6 grandchildren. Pat and I are both actively involved with Amateur Radio Emergency Service, ARIS, and public service. We both firmly believe that our amateur radio licenses require us to provide our community with our communications expertise in times of emergency and disaster. In late 2008, we moved from northeast Pennsylvania to Dracula, Georgia, about 30 miles east-northeast of Atlanta, to take advantage of the warm weather and the great southern hospitality offered in the Deep South. The new house has plenty of room for antennas, thank God, and I have a whole bunch of very understanding neighbors who don't mind watching me string up wires and erect towers. Life is good. The direction I intend to go with my portion of Beginner's Corner is to take a very simple approach to the technical side of the ham radio hobby. My basic theory is that since ham radio is a technical hobby, in order to fully enjoy and appreciate the hobby, you must become technically involved in it. Now, don't get too overexcited. I promise that our technical exploration of the radio hobby will be relatively painless. Relatively. There will be some math, but nothing that you can't conquer with a simple calculator slide rule. Yes, I still have my Krull and Esser log duplex deci trig slide rule from the 1960s, and I can still use it. Or pencil and paper. Mathematics can be troublesome for some people, however. It is an essential part of the hobby, especially when dealing with antennas. Understanding the math behind the antenna design can go a long way toward making sure that you are successful with your design and have fun and success using it. Now on to the topic of this month's column, batteries. Since this column was dedicated to the technically inexperienced and or new hams, let's start with something relatively mundane, the humble battery. About 99% of us who are active in the hobby have some form of radio that requires the use of batteries. Most likely it is a handheld transceiver or HT, handy talkie. With the newer HTs, there seems to be a trend toward a shack-on-the-belt type of radio. A shack-on-the-belt type of radio. To be sure, the marvels of miniaturization coupled with advanced microprocessor technology have given us some really cool radios. The one thing they all have in common is that they use batteries for power. With that in mind, let's explore how batteries work, the various types currently available, and the proper care and feeding of same. We have a subtitle, Batteries. What are they? Batteries are power storage devices, nothing more, nothing less. They have the ability to store electrons for use at a given time and place. To be sure, there are various types of batteries, some well-suited to our needs and some not. Here we will explore several of the most common batteries used in our portable gear. We're beginning with the nickel-cadmium Ni-CD. Until the last few years, the most common batteries used in portable radio gear were nickel-cadmium or NICAD. These batteries are rechargeable many, many times, and they are relatively compact, fitting nicely into a battery box attached to the bottom of your HT. Each NICD cell has an open circuit voltage of 1.2 volts DC. NICDs are handy, as long as you remember to properly recharge them, and especially not to overcharge them. One thing many folks don't realize is that NICDs are subject to a daily discharge rate of about 1% of the total charge per day. That means that your 12-volt NICD pack will lose approximately 30% of its total charge in 1 month. That is not a lot of discharge. Ergo, the need to perform a regular charging ritual every month for each NICD battery pack you have. Now, this might sound like a lot of extra work, but if you mark your calendar at the start of each month, you'll be on top of your game. Now, in the category of nickel metal hydride, Ni-MH, nickel metal hydride batteries are the big favorite among HD manufacturers today, as they offer a huge increase in battery capacity in the same size case. It is not uncommon to see NIMH batteries in the 2400 to 2700 amp per hour AH rating, which is almost twice the capacity of a similar size NICDs. This Extended capacity means that you can run to your gear longer without having to recharge the battery pack. Nice, especially when you are deployed on an ARIS racist exercise or real-world emergency event. The more capacity your HD batteries pack, the better off you are in the long run. Like NICDs, the NIMH cells have an open circuit voltage of about 1.2 VDC and take some special handling when it comes to charging. Again, use only the approved charger for your battery packs. NIMH cells also exhibit about a 1% loss of capacity per day, meaning that you need to set up a fixed battery charging rotation on a monthly basis to ensure that your packs are topped off and ready for instant use. I have two sets of NIMH battery packs for each of my four HDs. This allows me the luxury of having lots of power to run my radios when in the field. NIMH cells do not seem to exhibit any memory effect, which is a good thing. While various manufacturers claim different recharging cycles, it is standard to expect that NIMH battery packs can be discharged about 400-500 times before replacement. Just be sure to avoid deep discharge cycles, that is, letting the packs sit and not recharging them for months on end. And don't overcharge them. Again, a monthly battery recharging schedule will go a long way toward making your battery packs last. We'll go now to the lithium ion, L-I-I-O-N, battery. Lithium ion battery packs have come on the HD scene during the last few years, and they are gaining ground on the NIMH batteries. The reason? More capacity and smaller overall form factor. Lithium ion packs are expensive. They take a special charger that precisely regulates their current voltage and current. They have a larger AH capacity than the NIMH packs, and they can be discharged in about one-third the time. This is a great thing for ARIS slant racist operators, since it permits emergency communications, MCOM, volunteers, to have lots of power ready available for their gear. Now, with respect to non-rechargeable alkaline, now a word about alkaline and non-rechargeable battery. In addition to my two NIMH battery packs per HD, I also have a separate battery tray for each HD that will accept the humble AA-size alkaline non-rechargeable cells. Why? For one thing, AA-size cells are prevalent. As a matter of fact, you can find them just about anywhere on the planet, making them indispensable for the MCOM operator. Secondly, they offer a quick replacement for a spent rechargeable battery pack that can be changed on the fly. Finally, they typically have a longer discharge curve than any of the rechargeable batteries, which means you can use them longer at reduced power output. AA alkaline cells have an open circuit voltage of 1.5 VDC, as opposed to 1.24 and 1.2 VDC for NICD and NIMH cells, respectively. If you need a 12-volt battery pack, it will only take 8 alkaline cells in series to yield the 12-volt output, whereas it will take 10 NICD or NIMH cells to derive the same 12-volt DC output. Interesting, huh? Now, regarding discharge curves, although I didn't cover discharge curves with reference to the rechargeable battery packs, suffice it to say that most rechargeable packs are fairly stable, as in flat or linear modes of discharge, ultimately ending in a rapid fall off at the end of their discharge cycle. Obviously, the larger the capacity number of the cells, the longer the discharge cycle is, meaning the longer you can operate your gear without recharging or changing packs. With the rechargeable packs, this discharge curve drops off quickly near the end of the battery pack's usefulness. The non-rechargeable alkaline packs have a much steadier decline over time, which allows you to squeeze extra operating time at reduced power efficiency before replacing them. There is no right battery pack for a given radio. It is entirely predicated on your operating characteristics and the uses to which you are subjecting your gear. Personally, I would shy away from NICD packs, as they are rapidly becoming outdated, being replaced by NIMH and LIIN packs. Of course, the major drawback of LI-ion is cost. True, you get a lot of battery for the price, but do you need to incur the extra expense when purchasing LI-ion packs plus special charger when the cheaper NIMH batteries will do just fine? The choice is yours. One thing for sure, I would not lightly dismiss the lowly AA alkaline cells in this brave new world of radio communications. Alkaline cells have a place in the MCOM tool bag for sure. One final note regarding batteries. Do not just throw them away at the end of their life. Most batteries contain some real nasty chemicals that don't belong in the landfill. Take your special battery packs to a battery recycler for proper disposal. Green is good. Until next time, have fun with our ham radio hobby. Signed, 73, Rich, K7SZ. Well, I think I'll pause for a moment and dig back into the announcements, which are usually published in the beginning of the magazine, and give you some of the information on the ham fests that are slated for February 2010. February 6, Charleston, Hamfest, NARLSC, South Carolina State Convention. It's being held at Exchange Park Fairground, Ladson, South Carolina. February 13, St. Cloud Amateur Radio Club Cabin Fever Reliever Hamfest. That's at the National Guard Armory, St. Cloud, Minnesota. February 19, New Providence ARC Auction. New Providence Municipal Building, New Providence, New Jersey. February 27th, the 20th Annual Central Dakota Amateur Radio Club Hamfest, St. Mary's Grade School Gym, Bismarck, North Dakota. And on February 27th, HamCon, HAM-CON. It's being held at the Hampton Inn Convention Center, Colchester, Vermont. So if you're traveling around and you know where those places are, nearby to you, you certainly should make an effort to stop and get a good look at some of the stuff we're talking about and reading about here in the ham radio magazines. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings me just about up to time for this month's reading of CQ Magazine. CQ is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. If you want to call them, you could dial area 516-681-2926. Of course, the website is very well done, www.cq-amateur-radio.com. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. There is a website at http://www.handyham.org. Again, a reminder, when you think the word handyham, it's H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word, www.handyham.org. My name is Bob Zeta. I spell that Z-E-I-D-A. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. I'm located about 50 miles south of Boston, right near New Bedford, the fishing capital of America, on the way to Buzzards Bay, which really brings you to good old Cape Cod, as Patti Page used to sing about it. Hi, hi. My email, if you choose to make any comments, good, bad, or otherwise, is my call sign N1BLF. At comcast.net. So for now, 7388 N1BLF.